the ones who count, it would be over.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. So in the theoretical world, if those non-forcible measures weren't enough, then it would be open to the council to authorize use of force, which include what you'd mentioned, and other things. So we have cases where the council has authorized use of force. So the most obvious one, to my mind, would be the authorization of the use of force to eject the Iraqi occupying power when it was in foreign military occupation of Kuwait in 1991, and where a coalition of the willing was established, as was called, to use force in 1991 to eject Iraq from Kuwait. So it is theoretically possible. However, as you mentioned, and now twice, it is that this sort of discussion comes out of the blue, and it is a fantasy world by virtue of the fact that Israel enjoys the complete and absolute support of a permanent member of the Security Council, being the United States, which provides and has provided Israel with a great deal of diplomatic support, military support, and so on, to prosecute this assault on the Gaza Strip and the Palestinian people.
Are you aware of anybody actually talking about Chapter 7 being invoked within the UN system, or people who are on the margins who are influential?
No, I'm not aware of that. And simply by virtue of the automatic veto that would be offered up by the United States in respect of any such move. What we do have, however, what is clear, is a move to the General Assembly as a result of the lack of unanimity at the Security Council by virtue of permanent members' use of the veto, in this case, the U.S. And so there are other options available, though they have considerably less teeth. And this would be the Uniting for Peace resolution power, which I'm happy to talk to you about.
Resolution 377, which was passed back in 1950, around the time of I guess in response to the Korean War. Tell me about the Uniting for Peace resolution, because I've heard it mentioned on Al Jazeera. Various people have been talking about it, and this is very much why we're talking today. I was interested in hearing from you what you know about the Uniting for Peace resolution.
Sure. In 1950, during the Korean crisis, the Soviet Union boycotted the Security Council and its discussion. And so as a result, there was no way to get anything through the Security Council on that conflict. And the United States, interestingly enough, turned to the General Assembly with a resolution 377 of 3 November 1950. And that resolution basically said, look, because of the lack of unanimity at the council and the failure by the council to exercise its primary responsibility for the maintenance of international peace and security, where there's a continued threat to international peace and security, the General Assembly should be able to act. And so the General Assembly passed this resolution, and it empowered the General Assembly, if you like, to make recommendations on what measures both the council and the international community should take to restore international peace and security in Korea. This is what we call the Uniting for Peace resolution. Since that move by the United States, ironically, if you like, to create or vest in the General Assembly, or actually acknowledge, because the International Court of Justice subsequently said, look, the General Assembly has always had a secondary authority to engage or protect international peace and security against the primary responsibility of the Security Council. You have had it used in various conflicts, including in the question of Palestine.
Has 377 been invoked?
Absolutely. It's not 377 as such. There's a mistaken understanding that Palestine has never invoked the Uniting for Peace power or the Uniting for Peace resolution. Oh, no, it has. There is a standing Uniting for Peace resolution from the 10th Emergency Special Session of the General Assembly, which was first initiated in 1997. When Israel took land at what they call Har Homah, which is just north of Bethlehem, otherwise known in Arabic language as Jebel Abu Ghanim, which they wanted to then build an Israeli settlement on, huge hill with some Palestinian villages on it, Jebel Abu Ghanim, and it was empty for otherwise, aside from these few villages. Now it's a sprawling settlement, a concrete jungle. It's massive, and it closed the outer ring, southern side of Israeli settlements around East Jerusalem. And because it was so strategically important, and obviously illegal by virtue of it being a settlement. The matter went to the Security Council, and by virtue of a U.S. veto, was unable to get any action. So the General Assembly opened an emergency special session to deal with that matter, passed resolution on that matter. And since then, the emergency special session has been adjourned until further notice and then recalled as and when the General Assembly believes that the Security Council is unable to act by virtue of the veto of a single member, which in this case is the United States, and it has.
And that's where the Uniting for Peace resolution would be implemented.
Would be utilized. That's right.
The Uniting for Peace resolution, it provides for that the General Assembly can strike an observation commission, set up a peace observation commission, which sounds kind of anodyne, but it can also, General Assembly shall consider the matter immediately with a view to making appropriate recommendations to members for collective measures, including in the case of a breach of the peace or act of aggression, the use of armed force when necessary. So the General Assembly can, according to Provision A1 of Resolution 377, Uniting for Peace, it can actually initiate the use of armed force.
Well, initiate is the key word. It can recommend the initiation, but it cannot itself initiate. It does not have the authority to do that. And so this is important for people to understand, that the General Assembly can pass resolutions, including on matters that affect international peace and security, but they can only do so if the Security Council is not seized of the matter, see Article 12 of the UN Charter. But if the Security Council is unable to act by virtue of the actions of permanent member, then it can turn to the Uniting for Peace power, including this resolution, and pass resolutions that recommend. So you read it yourself, right? The General Assembly shall consider the matter immediately with a view to making appropriate recommendations to members for collective measures, including in the case of the breach of the peace or act of aggression, the use of armed force, right?
Could a group of individual members of the United Nations actually come together and mount collective action, collective military action?
Yes. That's theoretically possible.
We don't sail them anymore, but bring them to the coast of Gaza and start delivering aid and defending themselves and telling the Israelis to go away. And
yes, that's theoretically possible, but then there would be problems, right? The question would be, what legal authority were these member states acting? And if they were to cite the Uniting for Peace resolution, then the response of the Israeli side will be, well, that's merely a recommendation. It's not binding, right? There are ways around that. You might argue that by virtue of what is taking place in the Gaza Strip, violations of Hughes Kogan's norms, derogation from which is not permitted, including the prohibition on genocide, forcible transfer of a protected population, that is ethnic cleansing and so on, that states are compelled to act, right, through a responsibility to protect. But even then, there are arguments that would be open to some to suggest that, you know, these are political actions, not legal ones. You know, legal authority to do that.
But short of launching a military intervention, like a dozen or 15 or 20 important countries, you know, quote unquote important countries with certain clout, could boycott all Israeli products, for example, place a complete embargo on Israel.
Oh, sure. Leaving aside any passage of a resolution of the Security Council or the General Assembly, all states are sovereign, and each and every one of those states can impose economic boycotts, can impose diplomatic boycotts vis-a-vis any other state in the world. That is wholly within the realm of the possible. Absolutely. And so you don't need a General Assembly resolution under Uniting for Peace, under the 10th Emergency Special Session of the GA, to require states to take these actions. States can do those actions on their own accord.
So, Artie, in terms of actions at the level of the UN General Assembly or the UN Security Council, do you see the UN actually having any capacity to bring about an end to this conflict and the restoration of justice and peace?
Yes. The question is when and how. The UN is indispensable in resolving this conflict, indispensable in helping impose a ceasefire, is indispensable in ending the occupation and assuring the rights of Palestinian refugees to return, etc. And the reason why it is indispensable is because it is uniquely the one organization in human history that pretends universality, universality of membership and universality of application, or at least of fidelity toward the same set of rules that bind all states, all humans in the world, being international law and so on. And so without the UN, it would be harder to end the conflict. But make no mistake, the UN can't do it overnight and on its own. But what the UN can do through the passage of resolutions, or through bearing witness, or through report making, or through recourse to the International Court of Justice, is through these processes at the United Nations can keep the parties to the conflict and the international community, more third states in particular, alive to the rules-based international legal order that should be applied to resolve the conflict, without which you would have just more conflict. And of course, there's tension. There's no doubt that there's going to be tension by virtue of the fact that these rules, as we're witnessing now in Gaza, are being run roughshod over by the occupying power, and the occupying power is being protected by one state, that is the United States. But, you know, if you juxtapose, say, the inability of the Council to impose a ceasefire by virtue of the U.S. veto against the General Assembly's resolution just some 15 days ago or so, calling for an immediate ceasefire, and the General Assembly is overwhelmingly in support of that, juxtapose those two, and you can see the value of a GA resolution, of that GA resolution. And the value is that it shows that the international community wants a ceasefire, and that provides political pressure on all parties to do the right thing. Now, is it enough? Certainly not. But would we be better without it? Absolutely not.
Artie Imsis is assistant professor of law at Queen's University in Ontario. Between 2002 and 2014, Imsis served in senior legal and policy capacities within the United Nations Relief and Works Agency in the occupied Palestinian territory. His scholarship has appeared in the American Journal of International Law, the Harvard International Law Journal, and the Oxford Journal of Legal Studies. Imsis' latest book, The United Nations and the Question of Palestine, has just been published by Cambridge University Press. Read more about Palestine at the UN at greenplanetmonitor.net. In the early 2000s, Dutch chemist Paul Crutzen suggested that humans have pushed planet Earth into a brand new age, terminating the one geologists say we've been in for the past 12,000 years, the Holocene. The Anthropocene, Crutzen called his proposed human-engineered epoch. This past spring, a scientific panel presented its own proposal for how the Anthropocene should be defined. That proposal is now being considered by its parent body, a subcommission of the International Commission on Stratigraphy. If it approves, the proposal will move up the geo-bureaucratic hierarchy, ultimately to the arbiter of all matters geological, the International Union of Geological Sciences. Martin Head is a geologist at Canada's Brock University. He's been involved in all this from the start. Here's Martin Head speaking about the Anthropocene to an audience at Leiden University in the Netherlands last spring. If the Anthropocene is accepted as a new geological epoch, Head says, it'll only be 72 years old. Head invites his listeners to gaze into the future.
The problem, of course, is that the Anthropocene, if it's defined in the mid-20th century, the Anthropocene is only about 72 years in duration, not very long in terms of geological time. So we do need to look into the future in order to decide whether the Anthropocene could perhaps just be a blip, or whether whether we can have confidence in a changed climate for the foreseeable geological future. And climate modelling holds the answer to that question. This diagram is modified from Burke and others in 2018, and the IPCC, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Assessment Report 6 from 2021, last year. This curve is showing temperature over time, going back to the Eocene, about 60 million years ago. There are changes in scale here, but right the way through to the present, there's 1950. And then the computer models give projections, climate projections, temperature projections for the next 300 years. These are based on global circulation models using the very latest computing power that exists. Now, these temperature projections are based on CO2 emission scenarios, and the emission scenarios are in this graph down here. So this is showing atmospheric CO2, these are present levels, and you've got three emission scenarios. High CO2 emissions going into the future, low emissions, actually zero emissions going into the future, and an intermediate state here. Now, if you take those emission scenarios and convert them using computing power into temperatures, you end up with forecasts, basically projections of future climate. With the lowest emission scenario, which nobody believes is realistic, but the lowest emission scenario, where we have zero CO2 emissions, we still end up after 300 years with a much warmer global climate than we have at the moment. In fact, a climate which is approaching mid-Pliocene climatic norms. And the highest scenario, the highest CO2 emission scenario, takes us back to the early Eocene with extremely warm global climates. The reality is that we're somewhere between these two extremes, and that will take us comfortably, within 300 years, this will take us comfortably back to the mid-Pliocene, very warm temperatures. So it's quite clear that the Anthropocene is going to last for at least 300 years, right? But we can go further into the future than that, using intermediate complexity climate modelling, and without going into all the details, based on two things. Based on the longevity of CO2 in the atmosphere, it takes a very long time to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. And that, coupled with the fact that we have low orbital eccentricity, means that it's quite easy to miss a glacial stage. And we've missed one, we're going to miss another one. And we are prospectively talking about current climate state lasting for at least 100,000 years, maybe as long as 700,000 years. We're not going to go back to, you know, Holocene or even normal quaternary oscillations. We are into something that is really completely different. And there's no question, in my mind anyway, if you believe in the climate models, there's no question that the Anthropocene, or this change state, is here to stay. The climate change that we are experiencing is the result of large amounts of CO2 having been pumped into the atmosphere since around the 1950s. By linking this change in planetary state to the 1950s, as opposed to some kind of gradual thing, this does actually link human intervention to, and CO2 production especially, to increases in temperature. And this is something that a lot of people either don't get, or they think it's some kind of conspiracy theory. they don't understand it, or they don't believe it for whatever reason, because it's going to make their lives, you know, too uncomfortable in the future. So my point is that if we don't formalize the Anthropocene, that is the message that will be received by some people. And it will be capitalized on by industrialists who have a vested interest in continuing to pump CO2 into the atmosphere. From a geological perspective, it's actually very easy to recognize the Anthropocene, because you have all these novel materials, all sorts of signatures that tell you that you are in the Anthropocene. So this is a unit that is geologically real, and it all begins in the mid-20th century. So the Earth system science community recognizes the mid-20th century as effectively an escape of the Earth system's trajectory from the Holocene envelope of natural variability into some other state. So this would be a glacial, where out of the glacial into the Holocene, but we've now drifted away from the Holocene, and now the planet is either heading for the abyss, in other words, a hothouse Earth, or with the right kind of stewardship, it will be shunted off into a different managed trajectory. But either way, whether it's this path or this path, we're either looking at a long-term future which is completely different from the Holocene, or something that is closer to the Holocene, but on the basis of a human-managed future climate. Either way you look at it, this is very, very different from the Holocene. The political consequences. Endorsement by the geoscience community that Earth has changed its climate state to, if you like, a computer-projected but essentially uncharted territory on geological timescales is going to be very, very significant. The message for society is essentially, wake up, we are in trouble. And we have been in trouble since the mid-20th century, and whatever we do, even with zero future emissions, because we've stored so much CO2 in the oceans as well as the atmosphere, that we're going to be living with the consequences of the great acceleration for hundreds and maybe thousands of years to come, whatever we do.
Martin Head is a geologist at Canada's Brock University. Learn more about the Anthropocene at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. In medical school, students spend long hours poring over textbooks and notes to learn how to care for their future patients. And a growing number of students insist that their education must include climate change. Climate change affects health in many ways, from heat-related illness to the growing spread of mosquito-borne disease.
I think there's a lot of power in the students coming forward, recognizing that this is something we're interested in and that we're not getting.
Kent Boyd is a nursing practice doctoral student at the University of Minnesota, and he's part of the leadership team for the Planetary Health Report Card. It's a global initiative in which students from medical, nursing, and pharmacy programs evaluate their institutions. They review their school's curriculum to assess its coverage of climate and environmental health topics. They also look at the school's research, outreach programs, and campus sustainability. Schools then receive a grade from A to F. At his own school, Boyd and other students are using the report card to advocate for curriculum changes.
Like, this is what you've currently scored. This is how you can make this better.
So future healthcare providers understand the connections between environmental and human health and are prepared to protect both. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.